from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. A different kind of Sabbath begins at sundown tonight, a technology Sabbath. The idea is to unplug for 24 hours. No social media, no cell phones, no pads or pods. The organizers are calling it the National Day of Unplugging. The goal is to spend a day without technology, and that if we dare to spend a day without touchscreens, we'll be more likely to touch someone else instead. In the hour ahead, we'll talk about what can be gained when we unplug, and we'll ask you to weigh in as well. Could you spend a day without your iPhone? Okay, how about an hour? Half hour? We'll find out after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. 'Twas the night of the great unplugging, and all through the house, not a computer was stirring, not even a mouse. The iPods and iPads were stored by the chimney with care, soon to be replaced by an actual fire burning there. Or so it will be for those who choose to observe the National Day of Unplugging, which gets underway at sundown this evening. The idea is to give your gadgets a rest, and in so doing, rest your brain as well. An increasing body of research seems to indicate that incessant texting and tweeting takes a toll. While we may think that if we use our screens, we become demon multitaskers, actually in excess, we may just be getting more scattered and mistake-prone. So would you consider unplugging come sundown? Could you consider such a thing for even part of the next 24 hours? We'll find out over the course of this next hour. Joining us to talk about the National Day of Unplugging, Tanya Shevitz. She is the National Communications Manager and San Francisco Program Coordinator for Reboot, a Jewish nonprofit that sponsors the National Day of Unplugging. Good morning. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Levi Felix joins us as well. He's co-founder of Digital Detox, an organization that runs tech-free retreats and promotes more mindful use of technology. Levi Felix, good morning as well.
Good morning.
And just a bit, we'll also be joined by Matt Richtel of the New York Times, who's written about this subject a number of times as well. So let's begin actually by mentioning the Sabbath connection to this and that Jewish tradition, because that's not coincidental. There's a reason why you're doing it at this particular moment.
Yeah, absolutely. The National Day of Unplugging actually came out of a moment where one of our members was sitting on a mountain watching the sunset on a Friday, and he said, you know, he was in the middle of launching a startup himself, and he was constantly online and just overwhelmed by this deluge of technology. And he looked out on the sunset and he thought, I never take this moment, and I want to do this more, but I'm not... He's Jewish, but he didn't want to conform to the traditional Jewish Sabbath and had never done it in his life. So the idea that he came up with Reboot was to reclaim that Sabbath, the idea of the Sabbath, and to reinvent it in a way that speaks to a broad audience and to many people who would no longer conform or follow the traditional Sabbath.
So what do you help people do at the moment the sun sort of dips behind the horizon? Is it at all or nothing? Do you have to unplug everything? Can you pick your device of choice? What's the menu of possibilities?
It absolutely is not a rigid prescription of like unplug for 24 hours and that's it. I mean, the idea really is to raise awareness. So the National Day of Unplugging is guided by our larger project, the Sabbath Manifesto, which encourages people to unplug every week or unplug regularly, however they can do it. It's really, we see it as an individual thing. So if for you, it's just you're going to start with one dinner with a loved one or one dinner out with family where you do a cell phone stack and the first person to touch the cell phone stack pays the bill, or you play a board game with your kids, whatever it is that you can set a goal, a reachable goal, that's what we say that people should do. The National Day of Unplugging is just to raise awareness about it so that people pause for even just a moment to think about their use of technology and the impact of it.
We'll get a little bit later in our program to some of the fascinating research that's been done about the impact of too much screen time. But before we go there, Levi Felix, why don't you tell the story, if you would, about your own sort of moment of awareness? Because you were intensely involved in the high-tech world, as I understand it, actually slept with your laptop under your pillow. Where did that get you?
Yeah, so I'll try to give you the short story. I was working as a vice president of a startup in Los Angeles, living the dream, the tech world, had an iPhone, an iPad, computer, working 80-hour work weeks and loving it. And then I literally burned out. I ended up in the hospital with a Mallory Weiss tear in my esophagus. They don't really know what happened, but the doctor just said, you need to slow down. Maybe too much spicy food or too much coffee or just working too hard, but always on my screen, always available, kind of like a doctor, always on call. So I ended up getting really sick and taking a sabbatical, which actually sabbatical and Sabbath, there's a connection there. And what was supposed to be a 6 month, 8 month, 9 month travel turned into almost 3 months of travel around the world. So I spent about, almost 3 years traveling around the world with my girlfriend, pretty much unconnected with devices. And
you've now are directing this interesting project, Digital Detox, which runs, among other things, tech-free retreats. And you're also doing these events, one of which got a fun write-up in the New York Times last year about device-free drink nights. Describe those. There's one coming up this evening as well. But what happens? What are they, and what happens when people attend one?
Yeah, so you show up at the door. It's a bar, maybe a cafe, or maybe a big nightclub, a restaurant. And you show up, and we've got a cell phone check instead of a coat check. And the concept is simple. You give us your cell phone. We give you a pad of paper so you can have your personal iPad. And you walk in and there's board games. There's a massage lounge. There's tea. There's live music, typically fun, interesting, cello or violin or something different. And then there's, spoofs off of what's become so ubiquitous in the social media world. So we've got a wall that people can actually write on. We've got strings hanging from the ceiling where people can make art and hang it up and put it in the cloud. And so kind of all these puns about what social media, is doing that's good, but also how it's taking us out of the present moment. So these events are ways for people to come and get together and look each other in the eye and meet new friends playing board games. So instead of when someone goes up to the bathroom, you pull the cell phone under the table and you get that blue screen on your face. Everyone is, someone goes to the bathroom and you meet someone new and you get your portrait drawn. So.
And what happens in that moment of when people are having to surrender their cell phones? I mean, what's the experience?
Can I throw in something? We held a similar party last year at South by Southwest Interactive, which may be one of the most plugged in places in the world. We had several hundred people come in for a couple hours and also check their cell phones. And afterward, this woman came up to me, this young woman who, always has her cell phone on her. She said, my friends and I had conversations in there that we would never have had we had our cell phones on it. So I think it has a profound impact on people. And Levi and I were talking about it on the way over here, and he's seen it too. And I think if people have a taste of it, then they'll do it more regularly. I mean, like I said, it's really about doing this more regularly, integrating this into your life.
Did people fail? I mean, were there people who came to your event and said, no, got to go get my cell phone?
There's people who, they come in, they hang out for a few hours, and they go out, and they have to make, what if my friend shows up? What if someone's trying to get a hold of me? I'm like, well, it's like it was 5 years ago. They'll probably find you, or they won't, and they'll meet someone new, and then you'll tell them about some story tomorrow. And, for us, the big reason why we started doing the events, the smaller night parties, was because you go to these places that used to be public spaces and they've been reappropriated as offices. So now whether you're at dinner, you're at a cafe or at a bar, you can go from being a social space to being your office in a matter of a minute. So we wanted to create a space where people have permission to come and truly just hang out and enjoy each other. And by default, the end of the night rolls around and people don't want to leave. They don't want to get their phone.
Let's spend a moment talking about the work culture and the impact of this, because that's part of what's people feel is that the expectation is I've got to respond. If my colleague or boss or client contacts me, I've got to be able to respond. How do you respond to that concern, which is now the norm, the expectation within the workplace?
Well, that's the problem, that there is this expectation. So if people have a conversation about it in their workplace or just in the community, if it becomes this norm that you no longer have to respond to everything that you're even CC'd on, some companies are putting into place policies. If you're CC'd, you don't have to respond, because I think today if people get an email, they feel like, oh, I better chime in or they're going to think I didn't read it or something. So it's about changing that culture. And I think that there is a movement toward that. This is kind of the zeitgeist. People are talking about it. There are companies that are saying, there was an auto company in Germany that said, we will not allow you to answer email. They actually shut down their email system after hours. There are places that are saying, putting into policies, like, we won't respond. I just had dinner with, a friend from the Contemporary Jewish Museum who said that she doesn't expect her employees to respond to her because she's not going to be on the email after 7 p.m. In most cases, it's not an emergency. I mean, if you think back over your year, I doubt there are very many times when there was an emergency that you had to have responded to at that moment. And it's this problem of the expectation. And we've created this expectation that you will respond to every beep, buzzing, and ringing of your phone or your digital devices. And that's created this entire society on edge. So it is a shift in that that has to be made, that people need to say in a company, you know what, we can wait until tomorrow to respond.
Ironically, I think it's actually even more challenging sometimes if you work for yourself or you do a lot of work at home, because then it's always there. It's that you're always on screen. And you also feel this, oh, it might be if you're a freelancer, oh, it might be a new client. So the pressure is at home as well.
Yeah, and we deal with a lot of, we do events and also these personal retreats and help individuals through this process. And science shows that you're more efficient, you're more creative, you're more on point if you get more than 6 hours of sleep every night, if you don't, or if you're not interrupted during your sleep with your cell phone, and if you actually take breaks. They say there's a 20-20 rule. Every 20 minutes, look 20 feet away for 20 seconds from your screen. And they say there's a 90-minute, your body works in 90-minute cycles also. So every 90 minutes, you should get up and do something else for a few more minutes. And, when you show the science that, hey, if you don't answer that phone call, it might be better for business. Or if you shut off your work at 7, chances are you're going to do better in the business tomorrow. So I think this helps when people see that.
It's about setting those boundaries.
Before we get to the science, because the science really is fascinating, it sounds like you're developing also a few rules of or codes that might be useful. I mean, it sounded like you were saying a moment ago, Tanya, that just because it rings doesn't mean you have to answer.
Right. And so, what we say is that you should set out reachable goals for yourself. So maybe that's, start out with, I'm going to have one dinner a week that's unplugged, and then start making it every night if you can. Set a ritual that helps. Like if you say, every Friday night is game night with the kids and we're going to put our cell phones away, that helps. Find a hobby and do it every week that you're unplugged during. So I think it's really about setting the boundaries for yourself and setting reachable goals.
If I could jump in, if there's one thing that people can do which will change their lives drastically is if you buy yourself an alarm clock and you keep your cell phone outside of your bedroom and you don't do anything else, you'll see a huge shift in your day, because that'll permeate into your other hours. You wake up and you have 15 minutes where you're not on Facebook or Twitter immediately, but you're laying in bed or you're with your partner. And then you can make your way to the bathroom and then make your way to tea. And all of a sudden, you're having tea and you're not thinking about the work or thinking about someone else's status or thinking about something that's inane, like a cat meme that doesn't really, affect you. So take the cell phone out of the bedroom, get an alarm clock, set it to some music, and all of a sudden your day changes from the moment you wake up.
We'd like to hear from all of our listeners today, too, on this National Day of Unplugging, assuming you haven't unplugged yet and are actually listening to this program. What rules have you thought about? We've talked about maybe just if your phone rings, you don't have to answer. Levi is suggesting that perhaps you don't need to necessarily have your iPhone in the bedroom. What works for you? Do you have rules that you follow or ways of keeping track of your screen usage? And do you have questions about the National Day of Unplugging? You can join us to share those thoughts and give us your ideas at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org, or you can post while you still can on our Facebook page or on our website, kqed.org/forum. Matt Rignall joins us now. He is the Pulitzer Prize winning technology writer for the New York Times, author of a new novel called The Cloud, and has written about this issue many times in recent years. Matt, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Give us some sense of what the research is showing. First, on this question of multitasking, we all like to think that we're demon multitaskers. But in truth, what is the science telling us about our ability to do that when we're hopping from screen to screen and trying to do many, many things at once?
Yeah, I mean, there's science to address so many things that you guys have discussed. Multitasking, the value of downtime, why it's so hard to put this stuff down, and finally, why setting boundaries is such a mixed blessing. But first, on the multitasking, you're right, and I imagine your audience members know this by now. There's no such thing as multitasking. What you're really doing is switching tasks. So simple task to try this by yourself. They call it the cocktail party effect. Go to a cocktail party, try to talk to one person and listen to the conversation behind you. Quite obviously, you can't do it. You're switching among them. So every time you switch, it costs you neurological resources, it costs you time, it costs you focus. No such thing as multitasking.
And along with that, in a related way, you've referenced, I know sometimes in the past, the cake versus fruit study, which is another interesting example of what happens when our brains are full, the impact that has on the choices we make.
Yeah, there's a lot of I love this one, the chocolate cake study, and there's a lot of and if you want, I'll give you one about mice. If your audience members don't mind being compared to, actually it was rats, being compared to rodents. But there's a lot of interesting studies about a filled up brain. I'll just tell you the chocolate cake one. So forgive me if I oversimplify, but they take a group of people and half of them have to remember some numbers. And the other half are free of this modest burden. And then they walk into a room, each group, and they're asked, would you like chocolate cake or would you like fruit? And the members who have to remember the numbers choose the cake much more frequently than the other group, which more often chooses the fruit. And you say, well, what does that tell us? Very basically, what the researchers talk about is that the frontal lobe, this part of your brain that makes us most human, is not only controls our environment and helps us figure out what we want to do, it's sort of an impulse control device. When your brain is filled up with information, it's harder to make the right choice. So by extension, when you're constantly on your device, it is actually, not to get too weird about it, but it's affecting your free will.
No, I love this. I love this study, actually, because it actually explains something to me, which is that when I get filled up and busy and stressed out about things, what happens? I don't eat as well. I don't exercise as much. And there's a reason for that.
And do you mind if I give you a rat study that's related? Again, please forgive the... Actually, you want one more of these?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so at UCSF, they take some... I think it's rats, and they have them essentially experience something new, like getting on a table they've not been on before. And they use basically brain scanning technology to measure what's happening inside the brain. And they notice that when the brain has a new experience, it generates a new kind of signal. But if the rat does not have some downtime after this new experience, the brain signal, in effect, does not get encoded on the hippocampus, the memory center. It loses the value of that new experience. Whereas, by contrast, if the rat has some downtime, that experience becomes learning. And there are chapter and verse examples I can give you of research that are circumstantial, if you will. They're not about the device per se, but they tell us so much about the value of downtime.
Let's hear what our listeners are thinking about this whole idea of unplugging and what can be gained from it. We'll start with Teresa, who joins us from Santa Rosa. Teresa.
Hi, good morning. This is a great great opportunity. My partner and I actually took an entire week off about a month ago because we were so tired of the constant droning habit of constantly checking everything. And at first, I liked your comment about impulse control, because really what it was you get up in the morning and the first impulse is to check all the information coming in. And the thing I found the most was that I just had to reset my habits. So I got up in the morning and had tea or went outside or read or something like that. We're both self-employed, but what we do is we just have hours. We turn it off at a certain point. And in fact, every Sunday I have a no media day. There's no internet. We don't even do Pandora or Netflix. We just stay away from the screen entirely. And I think it has something to do with resetting your habits and your priorities. And it can be done. And I still feel like I'm efficient when I'm working and when I'm using media or the internet or anything. We also did a little trick for a while where we had to pay 10 cents for every minute on Facebook, because the time just disappears, and you're unaware of it. And I don't want I don't want to look back on my life and feel like I spent it all looking at Facebook comments or you know, browsing.
Teresa, thanks.
It's great for what it is, but it can be overused.
Thanks for those observations. I like the idea of having of finding yourself. Tanya, what are you hearing about how difficult, though, it is to do what Teresa just described? Do people struggle with this like a kind of addiction?
Yeah, absolutely. People struggle. And I'm the spokesperson for the National Day of Unplugging, and I struggle with it. I definitely have the urge when I unplug. I have the urge. I'm wondering, what's going on with my phone? Where is my phone? You have the phantom buzzing where you actually think you feel your phone ringing even when you don't have it. It's absolutely something that people struggle with. But I think that if you find that's the reason why you should plan ahead. Like, so plan a hike or plan to spend time with people or even plan to sit on your balcony or your steps with a glass of wine so that you're not just sitting doing nothing without your phone, because you'll be tempted to reach for it. Or if you're planning to just do nothing and relax, you know, be okay with that and know, you know, it's going to be hard and you're going to want that phone, but just try to resist that.
Scott in Palo Alto wants to join in also on this question of addiction. Scott, go ahead.
Good morning. I think there's a way to utilize our affinity in some cases and our addiction in other cases. And in the issue of awareness, when you become aware of something, nothing changes behavior or changes thought patterns, like just being self-aware. So if you think about the concept or the idea of Google Analytics, where it provides, you know, analytical information mainly on the user of the phone, the advertisers, I ask myself, why can we not make or allow to be developed with apps on phones? Why can we not make user analytics that would dig into the patterns and the data that's both created and consumed by users on phones, to dig into it, to mine it, to look for patterns, and then reflect that back directly to the user, who then just simply becomes aware of their behavior or aware of their patterns or their habits or their addictions.
Scott, thanks. In a way, it's sort of like just keeping a log, right, of your own behavior. But Levi, you were going to say that there are ways of tracking that?
Yeah, there are. And we have a list of them, ironically, on my computer, not my journal at hand. But there's one called Freedom, and there's a few apps, actually, that will track how many hours you spend on Facebook, how much time you're spending on social media. And
you could just write it down,
yeah,
right?
You could. But people are automating these systems now, so you can see where you're wasting your time. Yeah. And there's a new program, not that new, but there's a newer one where it actually lock you out of certain sites that you're spending too much time on. And it's kind of absurd that we've gotten to that point, but it's necessary.
Matt, what can you tell us about the science that's been done on this as addiction? There was a study at the University of Kansas, right, about how people were they tried to study whether or not students were actually addicted to how often they would text.
Yeah, and I will read you a couple quotes from students who did a media diet at the University of Kansas. This stuff is great, kind of to Tanya's point earlier. My day phoneless, computerless, and musicless almost made me feel handicapped. I felt naked without using any of my media. These are all different. I have come to realize that 5 minutes without checking a text message is like the end of the world. And I love this one. How could I abandon my closest friend, my iPhone? And that was a one-day media fast. And so researchers there, a guy named Paul Atchley, who's a terrific psychologist, neuroscientist, began to ask the question, is this addiction? Now, there are very clinical definitions of addiction, but the way he describes it to me in sort of layperson's terms is, if you're an alcoholic and I promise you a beer today at this moment versus a case next week, you will take the beer today. You cannot
And I'm going to hold you there. I'm afraid we're up on a hard break here, Matt. So tell us what happens when students were confronted with that choice when we come back. We'll talk more about unplugging in just a moment. This is Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. We are on the eve of the National Day of Unplugging, which gets underway at sundown today. And we're talking about that with the people who have helped organize it. Tanya Chavez is the National Communications Manager and San Francisco Program Coordinator for Reboot. Levi Felix joins us as well, co-founder of Digital Detox, which runs tech-free retreats. And Matt Richtel, Pulitzer Prize-winning technology writer for The New York Times, who was partway through a story about what happens when you give people a difficult choice, a bit like saying to an alcoholic, you can have a beer now or a case of beer later. What happens when people are given a similar choice with using technology?
Yeah, so Dr. Ashley at Kansas essentially said to young people, college students, if I can give you a text right now, or you can wait and essentially have some kind of monetary thing later, what is the value of the text now? What he found was very, very interesting, that first of all, there is a value to that text initially that exceeds some monetary value, meaning you really want that text now, but you do have the ability to put off the text until later, depending on how much money or value you will get. And that your ability to stave off the text depends on who it's from, meaning the closer the person is to you, the harder it is to stave it off. And so what he concluded is that this looks more like compulsion than addiction because you can stave it off, but that it has addictive properties to it. And again, I'm oversimplifying a little bit. He would do a much better job than I. And when you want, I just don't want to be too long-winded about it, I'll tell you about some of those addictive properties, because when you learn about them, you realize that it's not so simple to unplug as you might think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's circle back to that. In the meantime, here's a couple of suggestions that are coming in from our listeners about how they are contending with this, and love to get your reaction to all of these. Lorna posts on Facebook, so glad that Levi mentioned putting the phone outside of the bedroom. I just started this last week, and my sleep has improved so much. My family, Susan writes, is always plugged in, and it leaves me bored, so then I wind up plugging in as well. Christy writes on Facebook, right now I'm preparing for Sabbath day tomorrow. As a Seventh-day Adventist, we try to completely unplug once a week. And a number of rules are people that are suggesting in their rules for how to limit digital use. Here are some. Barbie says, we have a ban on in place in my home during which time the family congregates around the table. We have to engage each other personally without electronic distractions. Griselda says, we have a no TV rule for meals. Akil says, smartphones are like alcohol. Consuming a little might be healthy, but too much, and it's a hard to break addiction. Limit screen time with your friends. So it goes. Lots and lots of different suggestions coming in. What do you hope will take place starting at your device-free event this evening, Levi?
Well, I think it's just the beginning. I mean, what we do at these events is just one part. You know, we hope people are inspired to take this home with them. But at the actual event, people walk in, they check in their cell phones. We got an overwhelming 950 RSVPs to this party.
So do you think there's really a hunger out there, despite how connected we feel like we are to our gadgets, that people know sort of somewhere inside that there are actually other connections worth making?
Yeah, and I think this is the zeitgeist. No one really was talking about it for a while, and people are finally discussing this. I get on BART, and everyone on BART is on their phones, and I ask this kid next to me, I say, do you have any service? And he says, no. And I'm like, are you getting anything? He's like, no, but everyone else is on their phone here. So I was like, put it down for a second. And he's like, how's this feel? And he says, a little better. And I said, but it feels awkward. And I said, well, you know, and we started talking about the facts, and I started digging in with him for a few minutes. And he's like, thank you for talking about this. This is the elephant in the room. No one is talking about this. And I wish we could just shout on BART and say, everyone off their phones. And something I always joke about is, we spend time on the corner waiting for the crosswalk or wherever, or at a doctor's office. We pull out our phone and we get on Instagram. You know, we start looking at beautiful cats and dogs and sushi and sandwiches and beer and the sunset and people's faces, a lot of faces. And then if we just put that phone away, we'd see the faces that we actually can meet right in front of us, or we could see the sunset or the tree. And so we're sometimes getting lost in the FOMO, the fear of missing out.
It's Matt Richtel, it reminds me of another study, right, at the University of Michigan about how this behavior is contagious.
It is, and I just want to come off that when I hear Levi talking, I'm thinking of that experience of looking at Instagram, not as a media experience, but as a neurological one. And here's that those addictive properties about why it's contagious or addictive. What researchers think is when you touch the device, and I know you guys probably know this, but I want to add an element to it. You get a kind of dopamine squirt. You get an adrenaline rush, and in its absence, you start to feel bored. Here's something I heard that in this spirit of self-reflection, I would encourage something even as people are unplugging. What the researchers say is that our reward systems are being rewired. What do they mean? That you are so accustomed to having a stimulus response. You do something, you get something. You get a connection. You call up a website. You get an impulse. That when you set down your device, your reward system has been really pumped up. So even as people unplug, and I have this experience a lot, I find myself sort of almost frenetically looking around to replicate that level of reward system.
And that's chocolate cake, right? I mean, right? I mean, that would make sense then, that you'd want chocolate cake because it's another little squirt.
It's another little squirt, and you start looking around, and your brain is... And I'd actually like to hear Levi and Tanya on this, because I'm curious how you... Once you've done that, once you've unplugged... how do you begin, if they think what I'm talking about is science and not science fiction, how do you begin to restructure the reward system so that you are able to actually be in the moment rather than replicating the stimulus response you have with your device in your daily life?
Yeah, Tanya Shavitz or Levi Felix, go ahead.
Well, it's interesting. One thing that is the oxytocin levels. So it's not only dopamine, but when you get a beep or buzz on your cell phone, there's this thing, it's a hormone called oxytocin. They call it the love hormone, and it's what released when you're born. It's what released when you're breastfed. It's what released to have sex. It's when you're getting the feeling of being accepted and loved by the world. Your soccer coach gives you a high five, and they're finding that you're getting that from your cell phone, which is what makes you feel connected. But the problem is we're getting it at such high doses that we're not used to it. And then when you're not getting it, that's what I see at the retreats. People are not as much the reward system. It's more of the feeling of connected. And so it sounds, you know, the doctors or the teachers used to tell us, you know, you need 9 hugs a day. And it's true. If you have a hug that's up to 9 seconds long, you release a lot of oxytocin. And that oxytocin makes you feel connected. So we always tell people, hey, give your friend a hug, give someone a pat on the back, you know, give a high five to a neighbor, and you're going to get some of that oxytocin.
Don't you get, though, from people a lot of, this is sort of woo-woo stuff, like it's, give me a break.
Yeah, definitely. But I think that it's reached the tipping point. People are feeling like they need some sort of break from it. And they're feeling like they don't even know how to connect with people in real life anymore. They don't know how to have a conversation. I mean, you see it everywhere. Like he said on BART, people used to actually just, if you're standing in line or you were on BART, you would strike up a conversation. People don't know how to do that anymore. And I fear that we're sending a really damaging message to the next generation. Our kids are not learning how to interact. If you're not interacting with your kids while you're walking down the street because you're texting or you're on the phone or you're looking at Instagram, then that's what they're learning. And they're not learning how to interact with the world around them either.
Can I weigh in on the woo-woo question?
Yeah, please.
And I want to, but before I do, I just want to say one more thing. What makes this also so difficult, setting aside the neurological thing, is the survival thing in a day-to-day world where we are all sort of entrepreneurial and branding, and I don't mean that in a pejorative way. It is hard to be off this stuff if you feel like it lends to your employability. I mean, these are really hard lines to draw. And so when we talk about, well, what is a relationship, that very question, you know, is it virtual? Do you need to be in touch with your boss? Does it matter if it's face-to-face? I just say that, but just may I weigh in on the woo-woo thing?
Please.
I think it's really interesting that in the end, for me, this actually becomes an existential or spiritual question. Mm-hmm. I'm not particularly religious. I'm agnostic. I don't, I'd lack the wisdom to know. But I do think that we are all of us, many of us, searching for answers, and we escape into the phone to find it, to distract ourselves, to look for some meaning, to look for some peace, and when you walk away from it, it's not like those answers suddenly appear. We have been searching for millennia to these answers, and so it gets very scary to disconnect because you're back to where we started with some uncertainty. So, Tanya, Levi, am I out of my mind?
No, I'm I mean, this is, people say, so what do you do with digital detox at retreats? Is it just about taking their devices away? And I say, no. We live in an info-overloaded, noisy time where we're consuming, like, hours of media a day. And so when you put away the screen or, you know, whatever, even a book, if you put it down, all of a sudden you have novel thoughts. And you're thinking about things you haven't thought about in years. And that, to me, is probably the scariest thing for people at the retreats.
So is the thing that we're missing out on, if we're spending all our time on a screen, that deeper reflection, that question what Matt is posing about deeper questions that you just can't – this is something you can't Google.
Right. I mean, I do think that people never slow down long enough to pause and be with their own thoughts. And I think Levi sees that at the retreats. Like, people actually grapple with a lot of issues internally once – like, it's very difficult for them, right? Because a lot of stuff comes out that they don't ever think about. Like you said, we're compartmentalizing. We're burying it.
Yeah.
Let's hear more from our listeners next. Charles in Oakland wants to join in. Charles?
Charles, is it am
it's,
I on
it's
now?
You. You whoever you are on.
You said Oakland. I'm in San Francisco.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay. I'm a technophile. I'm a computer programmer. That's what I do for a living. I have probably 10 computers in my house. But I'm not always on them. Here's the key for me is that I have outlets. One such thing is I'm a cyclist, and I go on 2-3 hour bike rides 3-4 times a week. I get away from my technology, and I when I hear these things, though, sometimes I just feel like what was there before? I'm 50 years old. And I'll be 50 years old this year, and 30 years ago, I didn't have this stuff, and so I think, from my own history and just my own life, I was able to develop other things to do in my life other than just to have this stuff.
Do you take your phone with you on your long bike rides?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I have mapped my ride, and I also have Strava it aids me as I cycle, but I'm not looking at the phone when I'm riding. It's in my pocket. What I'm looking at when I'm riding is at the top of Mount Tam, I'm looking at the city.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you, Charles. Matt Richtel, do we know more about the kind of breaks that are useful?
We do, and one of them is nature. And Charles, you mentioned your bike rides, and the study at the University of Michigan basically had people try to learn in two settings. One, when they were walking around in nature, and one when they were walking in a dense urban environment. And they found out that walking around nature, actually you can remember and learn much better. And the relationship to devices is this. When you're in a dense urban environment, you are taking in a ton of information, even if it's passive. And I just want to emphasize that, even if it's passive. Even if you're sitting there in front of your TV, which is a device, or in front of your phone just kind of casually checking it, you are taxing that part of your brain. So here's what they talk about. They talk about exercise. They talk about getting out in nature. They talk about meditation and breathing. And I'll put a fine point on meditation and breathing. Here's why what Levi and Tanya are talking about, and Levi in particular with your retreats, people are coming and it's like cold turkey. Researchers tell me if you practice, if you do 5 or 10 minutes of meditation a day, you have in a sense set the stage for being able to unplug because you have made your body aware of what that feels like.
Charles, thanks for the call.
One more thing. I do meditate half an hour a day.
Okay, Charles, thanks. We've got another caller who wants to talk about meditation, and then Levi, I want you to chime in on this as well. But Vivek, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, in San Jose, yes, wants to say something about meditation as well.
Yes, actually, your guest brought up the point which I was going to make, is that I meditate twice a day with 20 minutes each time. And that, it does so much for me. It allows me to unplug at will without getting addicted to the media. It gives me a sense of feeling connected to myself and to others, so we don't feel disconnected because of the media. And once or twice a year, I go to these meditation retreats, exactly what your guest was pointing out, where you unplug and you find a way to connect to yourself.
In fact, thank you. Go ahead, please.
I was going to make this point also, another point, which is, this came up a little bit earlier in your conversation, is that we're looking for answers, and we seem to be looking for our answers in you know, in our phones, in Google, in Facebook, and things like that. But really, you know, it's the classic case of the must deer. You know, the answers lie within us, but we are looking outside. And meditation allows you to get in touch with yourself, where you can find your own answers.
Vivek, thank you. Thanks for adding that additional thought. I should remind myself, especially during this hour, to not be in such a hurry and try to get callers off the air. So, Vivek, thanks for adding your extra point. You run a summer camp, Levi, of sorts, right? Is that some of what you'll – is that important that it be that there's outdoor possibilities within that and meditation?
Yeah, so we're actually launching our first larger summer camp. It's called Camp Grounded, June 14th to the 17th, an extension of our retreats. Our retreats are for small groups, 10 to 14 people, and we had more people ask, well, we want to do more and more people want to come. So, you know, the idea is that exactly what Matt said, people come to our retreats who have never meditated, they've never baked or cooked before, they've never done yoga. The idea is that, you know, in a 3-4 day period, you can, you know, taste a few different types of meditation, or you can try hatha yoga or vinyasa, or in a very non-judgmental environment, you know, where you feel comfortable. And then you go home, and if you can do one sun salutation in the morning, and you can do one meditation at night, or even, you know, get small patterns out of bed, you just sit up and you just, you know, just follow your breath. These things really do change your life. And baking and cooking. And I lived on a farm in Thailand, and this farmer told me he woke up every morning at 5 and he would do all the dishes that were left over. And I'd say, you run a farm, you're the head farmer, you're doing the dishes. And he says, when I do the dishes, I don't think about anything else. Mm-hmm. And he said, doing dishes is the best form of meditation. And so for me, doing dishes was my first form of meditation. And then I had to catch my own fish while I was living on an island. So I had to get my breath to be a minute and a half to 2 minutes long. So I started meditating to teach myself how to breathe longer, to spearfish. And all of a sudden that process gave me so much space where I wasn't thinking. And then I'd come out of the water and be like, oh, give me my journal, I need to write. So this is the idea. No one can jump in, sit cross-legged for an hour. You know, the idea is sit in a comfortable chair, practice meditation, write in a journal. You know.
Do you have to know why you're doing this, Tanya Chavez? In other words, as opposed to being a should, well, I really should give up technology. Beth writes in that she says she a year ago for Lent, we gave up watching television. And in my own religious tradition, Catholicism, there's this the habit of giving up something, of course, in Lent. But it always felt to me like I should do that, as opposed to something deeper or wanting.
Right. I mean, that's exactly why we launched our campaign this year that has people upload photos of themselves holding a sign that says, I unplug to fill in, and then you fill in the blank. Mine said, I unplug to play trains with my son. And it's really having people pause for a moment and think about, slow down their lives and think what is important that they're missing when they are plugged in all the time. And so, yes, it's really important for people to realize why they're unplugging versus just saying you have to do this. And like,
can you tell us more about that, Matt, in terms of what we've learned about sort of what motivates people?
Yeah, I love the should question. And as a journalist, I'm always wary of should because I don't want to prescribe. But to me, the should is that we should understand what's happening. And I think for too long, we've taken it for granted. We should empower people to know what's going on, that these are much more powerful than we think, so that we can make informed decisions. I don't want to make them for someone else, but, you know, for instance, you mentioned The Cloud, which is the thriller of mine that just came out 2 weeks ago. It's a fiction, fast-paced fiction, but it's based very much on science about children's brains when they combine with too much technology. I think we should know what is happening to our brains when they collide with technology, and then you can make your own informed decision. But I kind of stay away from that should, because going back to that esoteric existential question from earlier, you know, it really depends on what you think life is about. And, you know, witness like even the partisan divide in this country. There's huge differences of opinion about that. At least know the facts. Then you can decide what's right for you based on your values.
It would be really fascinating if you thought about the possibility of President Obama, John Boehner, Mitch McConnell, Harry Reid, and Nancy Pelosi just sitting in a room and being quiet. I wonder what would happen then. Alonzo writes in, if Forum is promoting the virtues of disconnecting, then they should play a solid hour of dead air, eliminating the stipulation of talk and sound and promos and all the stable of blathering radio announcers would be a great shock to us media addicts in the morning. Okay, thanks, Alonzo. Let's hear next from Jen in Berkeley. Jen, go ahead.
Good morning. Delighted. Yeah, my comment is sort of two-pronged, if you will. What I'm finding is that because of all this inundation of technology and people on it 24/7, and that, the idea of having patience with each other in real human time, face-to-face, nobody has any patience for that anymore. It's almost like there's no room for human error, like being human beings. If someone asks me a very important question, I want time to think about that, and I find people getting impatient if I don't have an answer immediately. The other thing is that how I've detoxed is I have made a huge career change. For 20 years, I worked for Fortune 100 tech companies, and it was very frustrating to me because an email is not nuanced. And the idea of process has completely almost disappeared in creative departments. And so what we could be seeing in terms of marketing could be much more creative, but it can't be because of all this technology and the speeding up of time. It's not as good as it used to be. And so what I've done to detox is I changed my career from advertising copywriter to interior designer because I can do my drawings in 3D, if I so choose. I don't do my sketches on computer at all. The clients actually are really charmed by the human sketches. And I can interact with them in a 3D space and catch the nuances on their faces, feel the energy behind what we're doing, and come up with a great solution.
Jen, I'm going to hold you there, despite my vow to myself that I'm not going to interrupt. We're getting short on time. But thank you so much for the three-dimensional quality. Yeah, Matt, go ahead.
Can I say something about that creativity? This is where I think it's I like the points, but I just want to say it's very nuanced here. And for instance, you can say that creativity has been hindered in some ways, but in many ways, all this technology has been insanely freeing for the very reason that your caller brings up. We are doing things so quickly that sometimes we just flow creatively. We don't worry about being judged. I'm saying that in the larger context, which is we know we all feel this way that we're not, excuse me for being old and using this word, dissing technology writ large. But these are super, super complicated questions. It's not an overall dismissal of technology. It's more, at least from where I sit, a question of just being aware that there are side effects and that they are real and that they are based in science.
Well put. And let's pursue one that Jen mentioned, which is this question of patience, that people are losing patience. Do we know much about that? There have been some surveys done of teachers now who find that students are much more easily distracted, not patient, not willing to stay with things. What do we know about that? And is that a virtue that can come from this, that we'll learn to just that some things actually take time?
Are you asking me? Or
I'm just asking in general. Sorry, I didn't direct that anywhere. But go ahead, Matt.
There have been those surveys you allude to, and they're a little problematic because teachers. It's hard to have a control group of teachers 10 years ago. They say students have less patience, but look, here's one of the reasons why they have less patience. It appears we have less patience. These devices are hitting at a deep neurological core, by which I mean you were programmed in the jungle to turn around the minute someone tapped on your shoulder. That would not have seemed impatient. That would have seemed like a survival skill. Now someone can tap on your shoulder from anywhere by pinging you in your pocket. Is that a lack of patience or a survival skill that has been, in effect, blown out of proportion? One final thought on this, and it might seem like a cynical one. If you can show patience, if you can disconnect and take your time, you will, in effect, be at a competitive advantage because the research shows that you will have more time to create a richer, more thoughtful, whatever it is you want to define, relationship, product, etc. So if you want to look at this cynically instead of sort of existentially, you can put yourself ahead by setting some borders around your device.
Yeah.
Levi.
Yeah, I mean, to kind of piggyback off that, I really try not to prescribe things to people, so I just have a few things I share. If you have a startup, you'll be more effective and more successful if you take time to slow down. Instead of using Instagram – to share with other people, take time to share things with yourself and internalize them and get your working memory back in order. And I call it the intragram. And instead of going to a space and checking in with everyone, you know, check in with people around you. I mean, these kind of ubiquitous concepts of like me on Facebook, you know. And I'm not a Luddite. You know, I'm the ultimate geek. You know, I love my technology. To be honest, I built a website last week with my brother, and, you know, we were thriving from different cities, you know, collaborating and creating. And it's just to know, okay, where's the boundary? What do the ethics look like? What are the values? No one has created this for us. We're defining this right now. For me, we're in the most interesting time probably ever in civilization.
I mean, as many people have observed, technology isn't necessarily the problem. I mean, to paraphrase the old line, the enemy is us, not the technology.
It's like Edison, right? I can't blame Edison for developing the light bulb so I can work a 12-hour day.
Right.
I have to blame myself because I don't know how to turn off the switch.
Here's an interesting comment I just want to get in as we come to our conclusion. Susan writes, she says, I'm a retired physician who, while I was working, was sometimes horrified to walk into an exam room and have to wait while my patient continued to talk on the telephone. It's just sort of an interesting reminder about manners.
Right. And I think manners have been changed during this. The New York Times actually did a story about South by Southwest a couple of years ago, or out of South by Southwest, where I think it was David Carr wrote about how it's totally become acceptable behavior to stand and to be having a conversation with someone while you're texting someone else. Whereas in the past, you wouldn't be having a conversation over someone's shoulder, you know, while you're having that conversation. It's just completely rude, and it's changed the entire society's expectations.
Tanya, can I just say something to that? That is true, but I would say to the focused goes the spoils. Because while that might be acceptable, if you want to have the enduring relationship, personal or business, you aren't doing that with your phone, and it will accrue to your benefit.
Last thoughts from everyone as we approach this National Day of Unplugging. I want to ask you, Matt Rector, what you're going to do. What are you going to do at sundown?
Well, can I confess I did not know it was the National Day of Unplugging, but you know what? I'm in.
All right. What are you going to do, Levi?
Yeah, tonight we're throwing a huge party. UnplugSF.com for more information. And typewriters, massage lounge, tea, live music. Yeah, we've got a dozen typewriters. Yeah, come feel like you're a kid again.
And Tanya.
And I'll be checking people's cell phones into our cell phone sleeping bags at the device-free drinks.
Thanks,
and
all.
And be unplugged myself.
Thanks all very much. Tanya Chavez, Levi Felix.
Thank
and
you.
Matt Rechtel. Thanks all for
Thank
participating.
You.
Forum is produced today by Nora McCartan. Our additional producers are Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Katie Springer. Danny Bringer is our engineer. Dan Zoll, our senior editor. Raul Ramirez, our executive producer. I'm Dave Iverson. Go unplug, everyone. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.